This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I really have the great pleasure of talking to an old friend, Ishmael Reed, writer, editor, activist, so many different things that you've been. Ishmael, it's really good to talk to you.
Oh, David, nice talking to you again.
Oh, this is great. Well, maybe it's hard to know where to begin with someone like you who's done so many different things. But why don't we talk a little bit about you as a writer? I read the very first book that you ever wrote that I knew about, called The Freelance Pallbearers, blew me away. I think I was, I'd never read anything like it. I've read almost all your books. I think you have an amazing, unusual approach to everything. And but maybe you could talk a little bit about just how you became a writer.
Yeah, well, I was writing at a very early age. I think in second grade, I was composing things, and really got a lot of encouragement in high school, especially from a drama teacher who was actually a real right-winger. She was like one of these America First people. She used to give me these right-wing pamphlets that I'd read, and all criticisms of John Dewey's system of education and things like that. And I'd read them at breakfast and have syrup all. She never complained. I have syrup all over. But there was also a black teacher in grammar school named Hortense Butts, whose name now is Hortense Nash, and she encouraged me. But I was writing in high school mostly nonfiction, and then when I began at the University of Buffalo, I wrote fiction.
And
was 1956.
Were there writers in particular who influenced you at that time and kind of got you help you discover what your voice would be?
Yeah, there were two. James Joyce. My first short story was like almost a ripoff of Joyce, but mostly a cross between Joyce's Dubliners and Theater of the Absurd, which was popular then. Some of the Theater of the Absurd plays that we were reading. And Nathaniel West, who I was really influenced by his Dream Life of Also Snell, which was like a collage.
Right.
So I've been working with I have sort of like a paste and scissors mind anyway, just grabbing different things. As a matter of fact, Mumble Jumble, John Leonard, was it John Leonard? I think it was John Leonard who said, had a mind like a vacuum cleaner or something. And so collage did it my style. And so my first two books, the first three were influenced by paste and scissors mentality, especially the pallbearers, and my research on African American folklore, or African neo-African religions, I call it. So that's how my mind was working, and that's how I began in high school and college.
And if you had to draw an arc from your beginning to where you are today, do you think you could do? I mean, can you sort of trace how you got to where you are? All the different things that have influenced you is partially, the culture of the era that you lived in. But there are certain themes that appear, it's kind of interesting to see where they came from.
Well, I think I was interested in playing with form in the beginning, so that The Freelance Pallbearers was sort of like a modern gothic novel. And the second novel, Yellowback Radio and Broke Down, was a takeoff on the Western. Matter of fact, it was written up in a rodeo magazine. There was a review in a rodeo magazine. I call it Yellowback Radio Broke Down because there was a genre of pulp book, that dudes from the East would write about the antics of cowboys. Of course, they would exaggerate, and they were called yellowbacks. And radio, because it was, you know, more like a radio script, because we grew up on the radio. We grew up listening to radio, and there were shows like The Lone Ranger. And so unlike the generation before, the modernists, who mostly influenced by other novels and you know, other writers, influenced mostly by writing, we were influenced by popular culture. And so yellowback radio, the radio script, and then broke down was I deconstructed, or before there was a term, before it became a viral term, the term went viral, broke down the genre, the Western. And Mumbo Jumbo was like a takeoff on the whodunit, like a mystery novel. And then Flight to Canada was a takeoff on the slave narrative. I created the term neo-slave narrative, which has become an industry. I see the term everywhere, different courses in academia called neo-slave narrative. So that was Flight to Canada. And then there was a Louisiana Red, which is also sort of like a detective takeoff. Then there was a change when I guess moving to the kind of neighborhood I grew up in. I think I became the work became more biting. With my early work, Mel Watkins of the New York Times, Booker, you said I was sort of like Ali, you know, sting like a butterfly and all that. I became Mike Tyson when I moved down here. That sort of like began to alienate critics at that point. The Terrible Twos, the Terrible Threes.
So, would you? But there's always been a kind of political, cultural content, I think. You know, you've always had a kind of reach to, you know, even to tell a kind of cultural story and to establish a cultural definition. I think it runs through all those books.
Well, I think things changed with the election of Reagan.
And, yeah. Okay.
So I'm of course in my position I'm influenced by external events, and so with the election of Reagan, I saw that as a declaration of war on Black America, his election. So the Terrible Twos covers that age, that period when homelessness begins to appear and the breakup of the Soviet Union. Terrible Twos predicts this breakup of the Soviet Union when Gates of the CIA said he didn't have a clue. As a matter of fact, some Czech writers reprinted some of it. We'll talk about that's because I've been reading about disturbances in Estonia and Latvia. I have a friend who's the head of our organization, the executive director is from Latvia. So I said, this is going to happen in Latvia and people are going to sing folk songs. He thought that was ridiculous. Well, when it happened, the revolt began in Latvia, and they were singing folk songs.
That's right. That's right.
So the Terrible Twos took on that period, the Terrible Threes, and then I think Reckless Eyeballing came next, which left me as what I call literary roadkill, because I think African-American writers, especially African-American writers, have always been influenced by or been always persuaded to obey blueprints. And, you know, special interest groups believe that they can, you know, make requirements or dictate, at one time it was social realism and then nationalism. And, I wrote novels in which I had fun with nationalism, but when I did this takeoff on some of the more extreme positions of the middle class corporate feminist movement, I found myself up against people. I got a lot of censorship, as a matter of fact, from these. So it was then that I decided that never again would I be vulnerable to the dictates of an American audience and critics. So that's when I started studying Japanese. I wrote Japanese by spring, and I got two trips to Asia, one to Japan on the basis of the book being published, and I just got back from China. They're meeting it over there. So it's a big world.
And so how would you, how do you feel like the your activism in outside of writing? Because I mean, the writing that you've done, if you sort of catalog it, it's an immense amount. You not only have all the novels that you've just mentioned, but you've edited anthologies, you've written books of poems. You've done an amazing amount of output of literary writing and editing and creation. But you founded in 1980 or so, before Columbus Foundation, which.
In 1976, we founded. I founded before Columbus Foundation, and then I was required to have a. We had a grant from the Ford Foundation. I was, I think I was chair of the coordinating council of literary magazines,
Yeah, I remember that.
and we received a $5,000 grant from the Ford Foundation, which required that I have a partner, and I selected Victor Hernandez Cruz, who's now chancellor at the Academy of American Poets. And then we added people. We had Rudy Anaya and Alejandro Muguiro. It was a distribution project whose purpose was to get books by Hispanic magazines and books by Hispanics and African Americans and Native Americans and others to a wider audience. So we got challenged by Bob Callahan, the late Bob Callahan, this Irish American. He says, why are you, why don't you admit other white ethnic groups? And so he. Bob Callahan was, if anything, a very eloquent person, and he's also a publisher himself, and he had contacts with a lot of different communities. He was the one who connected me with the Tlingit of the Pacific Northwest, and which resulted in my becoming a appointed member of the Raven Clan. And as a matter of fact, I attended a potlatch last year, but he said he protested the idea of our being a minority, a third world group, and so we expanded. And then we had Irish Americans, Italian Americans, Jewish Americans, all different people represented from different, not representatives, but writers from different groups. And so we expanded to not only doing workshops and doing a lot of different programs, but we began the American Book Awards in 1980, and now the American Book Awards is ranked with National Book Awards. For example, the Washington Post said the American Book Awards was the American League to the National Book Awards nationally. The only difference is we don't accept any corporate money. This is our 30. We just had our 33rd year. And if you want to see the last two award ceremonies, they're on C-SPAN, 2011 and 2000, the most recent one, 2012. So we have that. We're celebrating the 22nd or so anniversary of Penn Oakland, which I founded. We're doing our award ceremony on Saturday, tomorrow, as a matter of fact. And hundreds of authors have benefited from both organizations. Some of them have gotten advancements at the institutions where they teach, or they've gotten a longer shelf life, or different things, interesting things have happened to them as a result of their receiving these awards.
So, and how does Before Columbus operate now? I mean, does it have a board of directors? Is it
We have.
part is a you know is it still a standalone nonprofit?
Yeah, we have a board of directors, and we're nonprofit. We've had an office for I don't know, about 20 years in Preservation Park in Oakland here, which is like one of the showcase landmarks where they gathered all these different buildings from the 19th century, Victorian, Gothic, all that, brought them to this one space. And it's a very beautiful, very elegant site. So we have an office that we've had an office there, and so we're all, we're still working at it. And we started out with people having a lot of fun at our expense, calling it Before the Goodbye Columbus, or a lot of different jokes. Now all the publishers, including the mainstream publishers, are competing to get these awards. Now, at this point, we have a MacArthur Fellowship person, that's me. We have Rudy Anaya, who won a Presidential Medal. for literature, we have the current Poet Laureate of California, Juan Felipe Herrera, and we have Chancellor of the American Poets, Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, Victor Cruz. So we have a very distinguished board of directors. I think we're talking now about having the next awards as part of the Miami International Book Fair.
All right.
I just came back from Miami and talked to Kaplan down there.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, that they have a pretty amazing audience for, you
yeah,
know.
I was on a panel down there with Chris Hedges a couple weeks ago, or last week.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's great. Well, so before Columbus, the main activity is now giving the, is doing the awards?
Well, we co-sponsored things at the San Francisco Public Library and events at with Steve over there at the San Francisco Poetry Center. And so we connected with other institutions in the area. And I became the first, San Francisco Jazz Festival has built a new building over there in San Francisco. Just completed. The opening night is January 23rd. I've been appointed the first year's Poet Laureate. And I designed a poetry festival for them that's coming up in June. And we have all our people on there, some other writers, including three Poet Laureates, for a poetry festival.
It will be a poetry festival connected to jazz?
San Francisco Jazz Festival, yeah.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, they're sort of like a, I don't know if you call it Lincoln Center West, but they raised $40 million or so. And they built a building, jazz building, you know, downtown near the Civic Center where the opera and the symphony and all those other institutions are located.
So it's just a little bit more on Before Columbus, just in that context, Jad, since you've been doing that for so long, how do you feel it's different today than it was, let's say, you know, late 70s, early 80s, in terms of being a nonprofit in the literary world, trying to foster, you know, diversity and bring to it attention of readers work that otherwise might be ignored or neglected? Do you feel it's like easier now, harder now? Is, you know, what are the challenges? How has it changed?
I think the people we began with are now the establishment. So I remember the Nation magazine, when we began, there was an article in Nation magazine called Ishmael Reed's Literary Army. And it was full of sarcasm and very dismissive. You know, the army won. I mean, if you want to call it a ragged army and everything, because by the end of the decade, you know, some of the people we have connected with whom we've connected and have won major awards. So, I mean, you know, those people are doing very well. I think the problem is that we still have middle persons, you know, coming between these writers and the public. I mean, there's been an explosion of Asian American, Native American, all that. Different writers and the establishment still selects tokens or, you know, king or queens for a day. You know, like in anthropology, I guess, like the Golden Bough, where you have, you know, somebody, a king for a day or whatever.
Right, or maybe there are these sort of fad moments where,
oh, yeah,
you know.
You got it.
Yeah.
And then,
you know, some like black poetry or black fiction will be popular, and then they'll, you know, publishers will jump on the bandwagon.
Well, right now, it's African writers.
Right.
We can't get our books reviewed in the book of New York Times Book Review, but they have, they review African writers, and a couple of them owe me money. I gave them advances to do anthologies. You know, I wanted to do an anthology for every country. So that's the new flavor of the month, but it's like Richard Wright in Paris. As long as Richard Wright criticized the United States racism, he was lauded, but as soon as he turned on the French, it was a different matter. So, I mean, these writers, they can criticize their own countries, but if they ever criticize the United States, you know, they'll be relegated to obscurity.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, but I mean, you're right about that. It's like, so like flavor of the month. And I think I'm glad to see that more people are writing from all different countries. But, you know, I went to an AWP conference, I think it was last year, there can't possibly be that many good writers in one period of time. I mean, there were thousands of people there, you know. But I think another backlash is they've imported people from the Indian subcontinent who are educated in schools where they must have been teaching some kind of 18th century English, so that, you know, you get this stilted prose, and the establishment likes that very much. It's like a British invasion. When, you know, we almost had it, you know, since colonial times, there's been a quest for an American writing. I think we're pretty much there in the 60s and 70s. And I think the backlash included a return to some kind of stilted, you know, some sort of like, I don't know what you would call it. But it's certainly not an American language, not American writing.
No, but on the other hand, I think real writing, and sort of, if you want to call it real American writing, you can't keep it down. It comes, you know, you hear, you find it everywhere.
It's on these blogs. It's in hip hop. It's on blogs.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think the culture is very active. And one thing I actually think, you know, I hear all the time, there are too many books, there's too many songs, too many bands, too many films, too many videos on YouTube. And I actually think it's true there are many, but I like it that there are so many. I think that it means that there's more likely to be really great stuff. You may not find it all, but it's there.
But no, David, some of my major book reviews are still run by Anglos. I mean, what do we call American Anglos? I mean, you know, who are very worshipful of Anglo culture. So they, you know, and they were very uncomfortable with the sort of stuff we all were doing in the 1960s. Matter of fact, New York Review of Books called it a peasant uprising. They were welcome their auxiliary troops to come in and bring this, like, yeah, you know, impenetrable, you know, stilted, pretentious, pompous style.
Well, it's what they call the culture wars. The culture wars exist.
Right, that's right.
You know, and there that's are right. Yeah, there, as you said, armies, and there, right. It makes sense that way. But do you think that if you today, the kinds of writers and poets that you're supporting and finding for in as part of Before Columbus, or maybe even in your anthologies, how do you think they feel about what went before them? You know, the ones who have, that you're looking at as kind of representative of the breadth of culture. Do they recognize what went before them?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm still learning. I'm still learning what went before. I just, before I went to China, I picked up two anthologies of 19th century African American poetry. Wow, that's blazing. Oh, those people were cooking back there, man, and they had everything to risk because you get murdered. But there were poets who not only pleaded the cause of African Americans, but Native Americans, and they had been removed from their own cultures, like their African culture, so they used Nordic and Greek and biblical myth to get their, you know, ideas, to get their images, to get their stories over. And they were criticized the president. There's an excellent poet who took on Andrew Johnson and put him down in a scathing manner. That was all. I think that was a tradition. My last two books were published in Canada because my agent said no American publisher would publish them. Published by Berica Publishers Montreal, I did some research and I found that that was the way that 19th century African American writers got published in Canada. They could say things there they couldn't say here. So I think what's happened here is that the kind of writing that we're accustomed to, our traditions, that kind of writing is in exile in a period that's post-race. You know, that racism, since we have a black president and black attorney general, racism is a thing of the past. When it's not, it's, you know, in some areas it's more pronounced. But so I'm aware of tradition, and I'm still learning about writers before. Like in Canada, in the 1850s, there was an anthology put together by a man named Benjamin Drew, and he went from city to city and recorded the testimonies of African Americans who had fled slavery and gone to Canada, and they paint quite a different picture of slavery than what was happening at the time, where you have you still have this, the merciful slave master. Like, you see all these people trying to clean up Lincoln, who signed an order that led to the execution of about 33 Native Americans. I mean, the biggest hanging execution in American history. And cleaning up Thomas Jefferson, you know, who was a slave owner. And they don't mention what he did to Indians. I mean, he uses the term extermination as his policy toward Indians. So, you know, I'm part of a tradition where I go to Canada and get my books published, and I'm part of a 19th century tradition. But see, it all changed recently when, say, we got hit in two ways. First, they say racism is no longer a problem. And it's saying that gender is the most restrictive factor in American life, which puts millionaires like Gloria Steinem in the same category as a black person, black woman being a maid in a hotel.
So do you think
that's
that?
That's new.
But do you think that really? How strong do you think that feeling that I guess that approach is? And you know, I don't know. I keep. It's hard to accept the idea that we're living in a post-race, you know, gender-neutral America. That doesn't add up to what I see.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's a job application, because the blacks are pushing this. You know, it starts out as a marketing term. People who were curators in museums, they found that blacks no longer had, in the 1980s and 90s, blacks had a lot of money to, at least they had purchasing power to buy a lot of books. And the New York Times said that the blacks were only ones purchasing books during one Christmas season. Then we got the recession, and so people had to market their wares elsewhere. So they had to sell these guilt-free products, very expensive products, and that's where the term post-race comes in. So you can buy this product and don't feel guilty. So I went to the Brooklyn Museum, and one of the post race celebrities, Carol Walker, who's a very talented artist, they had the Brooklyn Museum had put on her display the note that she talks about a period of slavery where there are no villains or no heroes. I mean, what are you talking? No villains, no heroes. I mean, you know, so everybody's all lumped together. Yeah, and it's some kind of kumbaya slavery moment or whatever. So that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with women, middle-class women, say that they're, you know, you might find a Sunday show like I watched last week about these women professors were complaining about their double oppression. They're making $100,000 a year. You know, what double oppression? I mean, that sort of like trivializes the idea of oppression. So those are the two whammies that we're working with. And out of this came what C. Lee Ennis, a black critic who's associated with Psychedelic South, calls the black boogeyman craze. So you got all these Willie Horton-type products. You know, I won't name any. I got in a lot of trouble naming some of them.
No, but can you be more, without naming them, I'm not sure what you mean by that or what he means.
These play theater and movies and all this.
Ah, right.
Where you got saintly, suffering, do no wrong, virtuous women surrounded by, you know, black boogeyman guys and cads who have no character, no lines. Matter of fact, the guy in Precious, which is the worst movie ever made about black life, makes W.D. Griffith look like a progressive. The guy he only has a sentence. You know, and so then Catherine Stockett. See, the problem here with marketing is that somebody like Catherine Stockett, who's a white writer, examines this genre, and she does one of her own, and makes more money than other people. Now the other people are in trouble with the IRS because they figured this thing would go on forever. And I said, didn't you think that an Elvis Presley type wouldn't come along and take this? So Catherine Stockett, she has her black boogeyman movie called The Help. And she made $38 million. And what she did was just like Harriet Beecher Stowe and Joel Chandler Harris, she got some black informants and, you know, copied down what they said, and she's making a whole lot of money.
That is true. There's a long tradition of that. That's the colonialization of some other people's experience.
Got it. You got it. That's it precisely. I mean, that's very perceptive coming from somebody from your background, because most of the guys who are, you know, in your group, they say we were paranoid. You know, I can call what is that? They say I've got a chip on my shoulder. One of the reviews of my new book, which is called Going Too Far, right? The guy said I was too hard on the Tea Party of the New York Police Department. You know what I mean? I said, you know, people living in two different worlds, man.
Wow. Well, that, you know, people are, you know what, I think what, it seems that a lot of people just don't want to rock the boat. You know, they don't want to.
Is that it? I think you're right. I think you're right about that.
They just want it to be sort of, everything is equal. Well, what you said before about the experience of slavery being kind of without heroes and villains, I think actually that is a theme that you people don't want it to be. Too many heroes and villains. They want it to be kind of just average. It's almost like taking lithium.
Oh yeah, well that's the line you get in the media. Both sides do it. Both sides. It happens on both sides.
Yeah.
You know, the false symmetry that they're trying to, and it's happening in other parts of. I mean, you know, when John Meacham, who's like the official Pulitzer Prize winning historian of the country,
right? He Jefferson.
He calls Andrew Jackson a rock star, like this rock star, Andrew Jackson. I mean, God, he was like the Eichmann of Native American policy.
Yeah. Oh no, see, that's the rewriting of history is to leave out the details that you don't like and focus on the accomplishments that you really think are meaningful.
Absolutely, you're right about that.
Actually, I don't know. Have you been watching Oliver Stone's "The Untold History of America"?
Harry Truman was very good for civil rights. I wrote a piece about Harry Truman and Playboy. I'm a contributor to Playboy, and I have this piece about Harry Truman where I found a speech that he made before in Harlem, before 65,000 black people. You know, Social Security for black people happened under Harry Truman, and he integrated the armed forces. excuse me. I was in Hiroshima. I went there. It's terrible. I mean, my daughter couldn't even stand it. She ran out of the museum where they had these exhibits and everything. But I read his diary where he said that he only wanted the I don't know if they knew the capacity of the bomb, but he said he didn't want the civilian population bombed. He said we'd just be like the Japs, his word, you know.
Yeah.
I see. And I just feel at that point that the military's power was the military was very powerful then, has gotten more powerful, so that no president can really come up against the military.
Well, that's what Eisenhower warned everybody about.
You saw those new tapes, the new Kennedy tapes, where Kennedy was recording everything in the Oval Office, and he's meeting with these generals, and he steps out of the room, and they start making fun of him, ridiculing him.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting phenomenon. But I do think that we have this situation now where no one wants to... it's sort of like no one wants to speak truth to power, and they want to kind of just, they don't want to be on the outside. You know, to be on the inside becomes a way of, you know, you travel through by apologizing and accepting, and, you know, it's, we're all in the kind of middle, right? Nobody wants to be on the edge. They don't want to be the person who's so difficult and contrary that no one will pay attention to them. They want to be accepted into the discourse, you know, the cultural, social, political discourse. So it's an average.
That could change overnight.
I hope it will. I mean, I think there are all kinds of things that never get discussed that way.
Yeah, but an incident could happen. But I just came back from China, man. That thing is ready for revolt over there.
Well,
this regime over there is not going to last. They'll be out within the next 2 years.
It'll be interesting to see. I cannot imagine it being painless if that is the case. You know, it seems like it will be a major upheaval.
Oh, it's going to be a major upheaval, but, you know, this situation over there where the members of the Communist Party and their relatives are making hundreds of millions of dollars on the side. I mean, you know, and the average Chinese person, is making $250 a month. And I felt it in the streets. I felt the tension and the resentment, you know, that towards the regime. And they had to have their meeting in Tiananmen Square and with like an army there, you know. told the citizens it's dangerous for them to come up there. So,
are you going to write about that?
I've written about it already. I'm waiting to hear from the publisher, see if they're going to print it. But it was quite. I can't mention any of the names. I get people in trouble. But I was guest of a university that's a radical university, the Beijing Normal University. That's where the 1919 student uprising came from, and also in Tiananmen Square. Some of the students who, there were 7,000 students involved in the Tiananmen Square demonstrations from that university. And so, you know, I was traveling around the Beijing, and I went to the Tiananmen, and I just picking up stuff that this thing can't go any longer. I mean, the prime minister and his relatives are making hundreds of millions of dollars. And the new premier, his relatives, you know, it's $300 million. I mean, that changed my, I said, well, damn, I said, Cornel West is the only socialist left. The world.
You can see that it in a,
you know what
in,
I mean?
Yeah, no, I think that it's, you find very few people who are willing to talk about the clash of interests that arise around the that political and economic disconnect.
Yep.
No one wants to, I mean, that's, again, I think it's too scary. You know, no one wants to talk
about
it.
We have the same thing over here. We have the, you know, the Koch brothers and all of them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, these fossil fuels billionaires, I mean, God, they're, you know, destroying the planet.
Right. Well, and 400.
It can't go on like that.
There are literally, I think the number I read the other day, 400 people control 40% of the wealth.
Well, they shouldn't be on the media, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, well, eventually, you know, but they, you know, that's, if you control the media, you can control the way people think about it.
Yep,
and so
sure,
it never gets discussed. Well, and speaking of that, I want to ask you about your publishing business, because you've been doing that for a while. And I see that as kind of also a continuing expression of your, you know, I mean, here we've started talking about politics. I very rarely hear anybody talking about radical politics.
Carla, get on the phone. We're on the radio. No, tell her to call back.
Okay.
Just hold on one second. Just hold on one second.
Okay.
This here we are.
This is Carla Blank, who is going to join
Carla
us.
Carla Blank, Rector.
Hello.
Hi, Carla. How are you?
Hi. I'm fine. Tell me what your conversation is.
Well, we've come to the point. We're nearly at the end, but we're talking about publishing. And Ishmael Reed, you know, the publishing business, the literary magazine, and I thought maybe it would be good. And some of the, and we've also talked a little bit about the way the anthologies have worked as a kind of coterminous expression of Ishmael's writing and cultural work. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the publishing and find out more about what you're doing.
Well, currently we have two Kenyan anthologies that are in the process of being gathered by editors who are Kenyan writers, and one will be poetry and one will be fiction. And so we'll publish them. We had published two volumes of Nigerian writers that were edited by a Nigerian writer, and they were picked up by
the National Center for Translation in Egypt.
In Egypt.
They're going to be translated into Arabic.
And they've either been published or they will shortly be published. And so that this is great, because Ishmael had made that arrangement with the Nigerian writers when he went to Nigeria, I guess in the late
90s. 1999.
And most of them are not known in this country. You know, we know a couple of people the same name, and so this was a chance to have, you know, some 35 or so writers get exposure in the United States. And then the other thing we're working on is a collection of poetry by a young writer. This will be his first book, who's located in Juneau, Alaska. He's a his father is Tlingit and his mother was Inuit. And his poetry is bilingual. He uses the Tlingit language and Inuit words also, actually trilingual, and English. And so he's mixing legends that are handed down along with daily life today. It was very, very strong work.
Yeah, we just published a Japanese writer. Tell them about Yuri.
Yuri Kageyama is she's an AP journalist, actually, based in Tokyo, and completely bilingual. And she wrote a short story and poetry collection that we published in 2011. And one of the stories, called The Story of Mew, which is about a young woman living in Tokyo who had come from the United States, which is what Yuri did, actually. Her father was a NASA scientist, so she was educated in American high schools and I think Cornell University, and then Ishmael met her at University of California when she was doing a master's. And that was made into a performance work that was premiered at the Bowery Poetry Club, and now it's being developed to perform in Tokyo and and come back to the United States. We're negotiating with a couple of theaters now.
So you publish books, I mean, these are print books, not e-books, or are they both?
Some of them now, Yuri's book is an e-book, and I think everything from now on will be an e-book. And Ishmael's magazine, Conch, did he mention that?
Conch is at IshmaelReedPUB.net, N-E-T, short for publisher. We publish people from everywhere. We published based on my travels. Like, for example, when I went to the Middle East, we came back and published writers from Jordan and Israel and Lebanon. As a matter of fact, we published some of the first writers to come out of Lebanon after the Civil War. Because we were the first two people to go, first writers to go over there, American writers to go there after the Civil War.
So do you find that, now publishing digitally makes it easier, since you don't have to worry about the physical distribution and the cost of books and, finding stores that will carry them?
Yeah,
absolutely, because have a huge storage problem.
I used to lug the print edition of Conch around, selling it myself at different appearances. So, but this with this cyberspace, we have people all over the world. We get stuff from all over the world.
Yeah, and then people can order it from all over the world too, the books. So that's very helpful.
And that also helps. That's also true of the American Book Awards. We don't have the budget of the National Book Awards, which are millions. I think they have an office even, and they go to the Four Seasons for lunch and all this, And I watched the American Book Awards in Beijing on C-SPAN. So we couldn't have imagined this kind of reach in the 1960s.
Right. No, I think the digital of course, the web has made it possible to do so many.
You didn't like my joke about the National Book Award people having a lunch at Four Seasons, David? I thought that was pretty clever. You're being very diplomatic.
Well, it's probably true, though. So, I mean, they do have they do have a budget, and I know they have an executive director. So, you just have to go somewhere else. That's all.
Right.
Well, listen, this has been great talking to you about everything, and I think we've covered a lot of ground. One thing that I found out about you that I didn't know, and I've known you a long time, but I did not realize that you had helped start the East Village Other. I want to compliment you on that. It was, when I was starting out, the East Village Other was one of my, it was a hero to me, as an act of publishing, as the establishing that you could do something unique, different, that culturally represented, the kinds of things I was interested in. So the San Francisco Oracle and the East Village Other were really important to me.
Well, Walter Boyd, somebody should do a biography of Walter, because he's one of the most amazing people I've ever met. And his whole idea of bringing art to newspapers, and there was Thomas Nast, N-E-S-T, he had just a marvelous mind.
Yeah, no, it was a completely amazing experience to see that. It was when they use the term mind-blowing, the East Village Other was a mind-blowing experience.
Oh, yeah.
And so I wanted to compliment you on that. It was a little bit of
No,
trivia.
we just lost one of our East Village other cartoonists, Spain Rodriguez.
Oh my God, I didn't know Spain
He
died.
died a couple of days ago,
I
man.
had no
72.
idea. Oh, I loved his work.
Wasn't he terrific?
Yeah. Oh no,
You know,
that's.
we are both from Buffalo, and there was a place called Freddy's Donuts that he put in his cartoons. So when I go to Buffalo, I'll go to Freddy's Donuts. This is a great cartoon. Thank you. And
Well, I think, there are a
the
lot of
cartoon.
cartoonists they love food, and they love, because
Yeah.
they sit there with a cup of coffee,
Yeah.
and they put those places in their cartoons a lot.
Well, these people in the Freddy's Donuts, they didn't have the slightest idea what I was talking about.
Is it still there?
Yeah, still there, I
That's
think.
amazing. Oh, you should go there and take a picture of it. I think that's
Yep.
great. Well, listen, I really appreciate your talking and bringing Carla, who I've never met, onto the line to talk as well. I want to thank you both. This has been David Wilk for Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Ishmael Reed and Carla Blank, and having a great time. I really want to thank you for doing this.